The following program has some naughty language, so if you are listening to this near little ears, make sure they have little earbuds, but you may also want to distract them. I suggest shadow puppets. It's Tuesday, September 13th, 2022, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. After winning the Emmy Award for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series, Cheryl Lee Ralph did what Tom Brady never thought to do after winning any of his 7 Super Bowls.
I am an endangered species, but I sing no victim song. I am a woman, I am an artist, and I know.
That's the Diana Reeves song, Endangered Species. It was inspired, and it inspired fellow nominees like Alex Bornstein and Hannah Einbinder to think, okay, you're kind of rubbing it in now. We get it. You're multi-talented. You know what I do? I just act funny in a TV show, which is what I thought the competition was about, right? But, you know, of course, it was amazing. It was so amazing that you could practically say anything afterwards, and you'd still wow us. So she did.
To anyone who has ever had a dream.
You know, you hear this a lot, and I never got this framing. I never got why it worked. You hear it all the time in movie trailers. For anyone who's ever had a dream. Are we all watching this in the theater supposed to think, wait a minute, I've had a dream. I have one almost every night. Last night, I was addressing a conference in my underwear. The night before that, I was asked to take a physics test I hadn't correctly studied for. This movie must be for me. For anyone who's ever had a spine and central nervous system, oh man, I have both those things. That plus the dream. When are tickets going on sale? Fandango me some immediately. For anyone who's ever evolved from a hominid dweller of the Great Rift Valley? Also me! Holy cow, I gotta see this movie. For anyone who's ever dreamed means basically all mammals. Well, maybe not the spiny anteater. The data is contradictory on that one. Then you go to the theater, you're all psyched for this movie that was specifically made for you, and who's there next to you? A family of echidnas. Right there, all in a row, and you feel ripped off. I thought we had to dream. But in all seriousness, congrats to Cheryl Lee Ralph and her whole Abbott Elementary family, and also the spiny anteater and its family, Tachyglossidae. On the show today, some good news, really good news for everyone. Well, non-Russian soldiers, everyone, but almost everyone. But first, Luke Mogelson, author of The Storm Is Here, An American Crucible, is here. Again, he's back to take us inside the Capitol of January 6th. He was right there, QAnon shaman on one side, the zip tie guy, remember him? Luke ran into him in a buffet dinner afterwards. So I continued the conversation with the New Yorker staff writer and chronicler of chaos, acute and stochastic Luke Mogelson, up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yesterday, we heard from Luke Mogelson, author of The Storm Is Here, An American Crucible. He spoke of spending time with militiamen in Michigan and Antifa in Portland. But if your beat is U.S. political extremists, there was one place where you were ultimately going to land. And there he was, Washington, D.C., January 6th, 2021. We picked the story up there. So let's talk about January 6th. You're there at the Ellipsis. The speeches are given. You write about, you know, at times being really literally swept up and crushed by the crowd. But there were also choices you made. And I think I agree with the choices, and the journalism that resulted justified them. But were there moments where you would have had to have traversed Capitol grounds, which would be technically against the law, even if you're a journalist? Were there moments where you said to yourself, ooh, I don't know if this is the right call. This is what I should be doing.
No.
That's fair.
I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah, maybe there should have been, but that's my honest answer. I was really just, all I was thinking about was making sure, you know, my phone had battery, it was recording, and I was capturing, you know, the most dramatic events in my field of vision.
Did you see beatings of police officers on the way in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So when I arrived, when I got to the Capitol, because I walked, you know, from the Washington Monument up the mall because everybody else was doing that. And by the time I got up there to the Capitol, the kind of tip of the spear, which was the Proud Boys and a group of other Trump supporters, had already breached the outer perimeter of metal barriers, and the police had retreated to the foot of the steps.
To protect the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign and domestic!
And if you remember, those steps were covered by bleachers that had been erected in anticipation right. of the inauguration. And those bleachers had been wrapped in kind of a tarpaulin. So basically, to get up to the upper terrace, where the windows were and the doors were to enter the Capitol, you had to go through the understructure of the bleachers up the stairs. And there was an opening in them, and the police were guarding that opening. And yeah, the Trump supporters were pelting them with baldos and projectiles, swinging punches at them, linking arms, turning their backs and ramming the wall of riot shields. They eventually did get through, and then there was another line of police inside the bleachers using rubber bullet guns and batons and just, wildly all-out brawling with Trump supporters on the steps.
How'd you decide which group you followed?
Well, didn't really. I was kind of just swept away with the flow of the mob, and I went up the steps after they had gone through that second line. And when I emerged on the terrace, I saw that there were people entering the building through a broken window. And actually a kind of line had formed there, people pouring into the Capitol through that window, which we now know had been shattered by a Proud Boy with a riot shield that he had taken off of a police officer.
They broke the glass in the United States Capitol, and now they are climbing through the window. This happened moments ago.
How many people had been in? Well, you can't tell what happened before you, but do you know where you were in terms of the timeline of people pouring into the Capitol?
Well, it's interesting because do you remember that footage by the HuffPost reporter who was covering the certification from inside?
Right. This was footage of the very brave officer who kind of lured away a bunch of the protesters, knowingly
right.
lured them away from the most sensitive areas in the Senate floor.
Right. So the window that everybody was going into, once you emerged on the other side, there was a kind of hallway and a staircase directly to the left. And that staircase, that marble staircase, led up towards the Senate chamber. And that's where the very first people through they went up those stairs, encountered Goodman. He diverted them, you know, from the Senate, which was in the process of being evacuated. By the time I went through the window, there was a line of officers right inside, directly to the left, blocking that staircase. So everybody who came in, rather than trying to go through that line of officers, they just took, they were taking the path of least resistance and turning right. And so I followed, you know, the crowd right down that hallway, which led basically to the rotunda.
But it's not like you picked out certain leaders or certain people that you thought might know what they were doing.
No, absolutely not. And some of the, like some of the details in the book, because I identify quite a few people in the mob in my description of the attack. But a lot of that I got from the video that I took. So in the moment itself, I wasn't aware of who everybody was around me. But when I went back and was able to really look carefully at the video that I recorded on my phone, I was able to, you know, pick out individuals like Joe Biggs, one of the Proud Boy leaders, and other folks, including some of the leaders of the Michigan group that organized that first protest in Lansing back in April.
So when you were inside the Senate chamber, and I ask, you've probably seen Luke's video, think back about, you have the QAnon shaman, quote unquote, presiding over the chamber.
To allow us to send a message to all the tyrants, the communists, and the globalists, that this is our...
You have people rifling through the desks. There's a moment where a Capitol Hill police officer, knowing he's outnumbered and counting the number of people around him, he counts you as one of them. I think there was five of them and one of you. Gently suggests they leave the chamber and do the right thing.
Any chance I could get you guys to leave the Senate wing?
We will. I've been making sure they ain't disrespecting the place.
Okay, just want to let you guys know, this is like the sacredest place.
As you're experiencing it at the time, you're shooting film, you're trying to chronicle it. When you look back on it, maybe your reflections on it change from the day after, the week after, till now. What do you make of their behavior once they got inside the inner sanctum?
Yeah, it was interesting because almost all of the violence that I witnessed took place outside. And the reason there was violence was because the police were preventing them from entering the Capitol. And so once they overcame that resistance and achieved what they had been, what their objective essentially, they were kind of at a loss, a lot of them, as to what to do. And also, you know, there were no, the lawmakers had all already been successfully evacuated. So I think it would have been a very different story if that hadn't been the case, if some of these rioters had actually managed to get their hands on some politicians. But given that, you know, the Senate chamber was empty by the time they entered it, they didn't really know how to proceed from that point.
I'm not going to say they were reverent, but they seemed so much more subdued than not just outside, but actually than I expected them to be. As they rifled through senators' desks, they seemed almost, you know, they did steal some papers or whatever, but they seemed almost to be like kids caught in a classroom after school is out and they know they shouldn't be there.
A bit, yeah. I mean, certainly a fair number of them, you know, had never been in DC and were just a little bit nonplussed and taken aback by the fact that, you know, they had succeeded in storming the Capitol. And again, I think that there was also a dispersal of the mob. So there was a kind of scattering of the mob energy that propelled the initial assault against the Capitol. And once you have, you know, five people in a room together, it's a much different vibe. It's a much different energy than if you are one of, you know, 10,000.
Yeah.
No, this is our chair.
I agree with you, brother, but it's not ours.
We're a democracy.
It belongs to the Vice President of the United States.
Yeah.
When he's in here, it's not our chair. Look, I love you.
They were suddenly no longer, you know, anonymous members of a mob.
Right. What do you make of the police officer's intervention?
It was very complicated and contradictory and impossible to generalize about, because first of all, different officers comported themselves in different ways. And then also at different places and different times during the day, the dynamic varied dramatically. So as I said, the officers attempting to prevent the rioters from entering the building really bore the brunt of the violence. And it was horrific. I mean, you've seen the video. I saw it with my own eyes. It was full on, no holds barred, hand-to-hand combat. Then once inside the building, I think that some officers opted to adopt a tactic of de-escalation. And the, unfortunately, you can't attribute that decision to the fact that they were outnumbered, because at a certain point, they weren't outnumbered. So like in the Senate chamber, for example, you mentioned that there were five of us and one of them at one point, which is true. But then other officers came a few minutes later. And at some point, a whole phalanx of Metropolitan Police entered the chamber. And I was sure that they were going to seal the doors, you know, search everybody, arrest everybody, confiscate our phones, you know, at least make sure people weren't leaving with, you know, senators' private possessions and documents. But instead, everybody was politely asked and allowed to exit the Senate, then politely escorted, by the way, by police that had clearly recently engaged in tough fighting. I mean, their uniforms were ripped, their hair was messed up.
One was covered in the powder of a fire extinguisher, right?
Yeah. And they were kind of laughing and joking with the Trump supporters. And everybody that had been in the Senate chamber was then directed to a staircase, down a side hallway, and out a fire exit. And the remarkable thing was that once those people left the Capitol, they just went around the corner to the north end, where another group, much larger group of Trump supporters, was attacking another entrance. Violently attacking the police, using metal barricades as battering rams. And several of the men who I had seen inside the Senate chamber and who I had seen leave with senators' documents joined this renewed offensive against other officers on the north end.
Were all the people you were with inside the Senate chamber arrested eventually?
I don't think all of them were, but most of them were. Most of them were. At one point, there were several dozen people in there.
Okay. Now, I know the January 6th committee got testimony from a British documentary filmmaker, Alex Holder, and another documentary filmmaker named Nick Questa testified on TV. Did they, I would assume, they would have approached you, and how did those conversations go?
They didn't approach me.
No?
No.
Huh.
Shortly after the New Yorker published about a 13-minute edit of the video that I took that day, people from the FBI reached out to ask for all of my video, and I didn't give it to them. And I told them that I didn't feel comfortable sharing that with them. And we had kind of thought that we might be subpoenaed and were preparing for that, but it never happened. And I was never contacted again by anybody in the government.
I would say that's the right decision, though I don't know exactly what else is on the video. I would assume if it's, you know, anyone committing heinous crimes, maybe there'd be a tougher question to ask yourself.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's, you know, I wasn't there when Ashley Babbitt was killed, and there was, you know, that was a much more kind of violent confrontation than anything I saw inside the Capitol.
And there's really clear, and not the moment of the bullet impact, but there's very clear video evidence of that, absent whatever you could have had.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, not by journalists. Although they're my friend, the photographer Victor Blue, he was there and photographed the whole thing, and actually had trouble publishing those photographs. But most of the video that we do have of that incident is just from, yeah, members of the mob.
Why trouble publishing the photographs?
Well, I think because there's a reluctance among media outlets to publish graphic images like that. But it's, in my opinion, a reluctance that reflects a double standard, because, you know, outlets often publish pictures of dead people and graphic violence in other parts of the world. And I think there's probably a fear among some of these outlets of provoking, you know, far right extremists.
Yeah.
And kind of offering material or content that might be misused by some of these propagandists and conspiracy theorists that have constructed alternate versions of what happened with Ashley Babbitt's death. And I, just for the record, don't agree with that decision whatsoever. And neither does Victor, by the way. We were both very frustrated that he wasn't able to publish those photos.
What do you make of the general anti-platforming argument, which would say you're talking to some of the more horrible people in our society, you're asking them for their opinions and their tactics, you're getting to know them, you're presenting their opinions through your journalism. Now, to be fair, you do this with the Proud Boys as well as you do it with and the Groypers, as well as you would do it with Antifa protesters and Black Lives Matter protesters who aren't part of any group before the day they came out. So it's not a matter of inconsistency, but the argument is just don't put these opinions out there. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I mean, I think it's ridiculous. I'm a journalist, so the people who hold that position are essentially, you know, asking me not to do my job. And we've seen how far, you know, sticking our heads in the sand gets us. I think that's kind of why we got into this situation in the first place. Yeah, my job is definitely not to hide or water down the ugly parts of this country from my fellow citizens. It's to blast a light on it.
And lastly, one of the takeaways from the book for me, tactically, on smaller levels, I had a number of takeaways about what went wrong, what went right, if anything, what's driving the psychology of the actors. But I could not say that a takeaway from this book is something like violence isn't the answer. Over and over again, from what you chronicle, it turns out violence was a pretty useful tactic or tool for almost all the people who were involved. There are occasionally people who get kind of drummed out of Antifa because they stood in the way of violence. But for the most part, I would say that you cannot conclude, there is not evidence that you put forward that violence isn't the answer, although I'd like it to be true. What do you think of that?
I think that that's a very interesting takeaway from the book. Wasn't my intention in writing the book that readers would draw that conclusion. But, you know, after the riot at the Capitol, when Congress reconvened and Mike Pence returned to the dais that had just recently been occupied by Jacob Chansley, a.k.a. the Q Shaman, he said that the vice president, Mike Pence, said that violence never wins. And they proceeded to hold a vote on the certification. And a lot of Americans have, I think, drawn comfort from the fact that the same day government was able to effectuate a peaceful transition of power, notwithstanding all the efforts of the mob and Trump and his allies. But let's not forget that 147 Republicans voted against certifying the election. And, you know, that's a majority of the caucus. And those politicians again, a majority of Republicans sided with the mob that day. And let's look at where we are now and going into 2024. I think that you can make an argument that January 6th has galvanized and emboldened the right. So I don't agree with Vice President Pence's assessment that violence never wins. And I think that, you know, any honest look at the world and our own history reveals that statement to be false, unfortunately.
And you could read that coverage in The New Yorker, where Luke Mogelson's been writing for almost a decade. His book is called The Storm Is Here, An American Crucible. Luke, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
And now the spiel. Really good news has been dominating the world the last few days. And if you said to yourself, oh, really? Wait, what is it? Tells you a lot about the kind of tough time that anything but pessimism or tumult has for breaking through. But I do, of course, mean, or mostly mean, Ukraine. The advance of the Ukrainian troops pushing back the Russians has been widely chronicled. Territory gains and Ukrainians in a much better position to escape subjugation and death. Now, in some quarters in the U.S., there is a disinclination to revel in or to feel good about war news. This is misplaced. I guess most people just are, quote, against war or don't want to feel like the kind of people who cheer on military victories. But I got to tell you, military victories are a lot better than military defeats if you're going down to a bunch of people who do want to put you under their heel, make you live their lifestyle, and possibly kill you and your family along the way. Successfully winning a war against a tyrant should be celebrated. Losing a war is a lot worse than not losing it. Losing to an illegitimate aggressor bent on war crimes, that's even worse still. But it's not the only news that's really good news. In fact, it's not the only war news that's good news. Today, we got so much news. We were exposed to so much news that was so good. Well, today, in the last couple of days, just a litany of great news, and I bet you didn't even notice it. So broadly speaking, inflation is still high, and the new report came out, and it's not great. It lowered a bit, but not so much. But let's just stick with the war news, something kind of a little more important to the people involved than 8.1% inflation, which is bad for Americans, but not as bad as what was going on in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. It's one of three wars in the world currently being waged. However, the Tigray People's Liberation Front announced that they're willing to abide by an immediate ceasefire, which was broken months ago, and they will come to the negotiation table with the Ethiopian government. They're committed to participate in the peace process under the auspices of the African Union. The United States encouraged Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to, quote, seize the opportunity for peace. Yes, war, of course, is not the only horseman of the apocalypse. Fame, pestilence, death. It brings us to the Goalkeepers Report. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which I guess you got to pause a little bit more in between those two names, Bill and also this lady named Melinda or Melinda. Yeah, you might remember Bill. They're not really on the same page. They actually now issue two different takes on the Goalkeepers Report on global progress. But this is their huge foundation just trying to improve the world. I cracked open the Goalkeepers Report and it had these words. We need to speed up the pace of our progress five times faster to meet most of our goals. And that might even be an underestimate. As bad as the data makes it seem, the real situation might be even worse. So why am I including this in what I called a litany of really good news? Well, the next phrase, or it might be better. And I have to say, a fair reading of the Goalkeepers Report shows just how much better things are getting. They have a dozen or so metrics where they go into the world and they try to improve things. And things are improving. Things are greatly improving in some regions. Let's just go by some of their metrics. Stunted growth. Children who have stunted growth. Malnutrition. It's gone from 33% of the world to 23% of the world. That's significant. It's been cut in half in Southeast Asia. What about neonatal death? Cut in half throughout the world since 1990. Latin America, even better than the world average. In North Africa and the Middle East, neonatal death has been cut by two-thirds. Today, 58% of the world's population uses safely managed sanitation. Now, if that's glass half full, literally clean water glass half full, think about where we started. When they started measuring, 1990, 29% of the world's population had safely managed sanitation. It has literally doubled in the time they've been looking at it. I was alerted to many of these advances in the report itself by Derek Thompson in The Atlantic, and I think Thompson is right to point to AIDS as an area of such great improvement. When they were doing predictions about AIDS decades ago, they forecast that 5 million people would die of AIDS in 2020. I remember in the early 80s, the forecasts were even more dire than this. But, you know, almost 20 years ago, George W. Bush announced the PEPFAR program combating HIV in Africa. And it's worked. Not just that, but all these global health organizations and pharmaceutical companies and the organizations that get the expensive drugs to the people who need them. So instead of 5 million people dying of AIDS, 500,000 people are dying of AIDS. You could look at it and say 500,000 people are dying of AIDS. You could say that's 90% better than the forecast would have predicted. Tropical diseases, the prevalence of, they have a grab bag of 15 neglected tropical diseases per 100,000 people, have been cut significantly. In Southeast Asia, to take one region out of 100,000 people, 71,000 people in 1990 used to have these diseases. Now it's 12,000. It went from something being more than common, being prevalent in the entire region of Southeast Asia, to something being rare, quite rare indeed. So that's internationally. Some of these statistics are talking about how the United States is improving. But the United States, specifically, the fate of our poorest children is doing so much better than we ever thought. I read about this in the New York Times, and a journalist there, Jason DeParle, who's been covering childhood poverty, all kinds of poverty, and he's just a great chronicler of the anguish circumstances on the ground. He's there when people get evicted from apartments. He's there when kids wait at food pantries. But he, the New York Times, in collaboration with a group called Child Trends, have documented that since 1993, child poverty has dropped by 59%. The reasons why are fascinating. It's mostly that the safety net is stitched fairly well. It works in different ways. Some programs work great. Some programs work less great. But child poverty, which is one of the main reasons why you organize a society, child poverty has come down by more than half. All the caveats obtain. Yes, just being above the poverty line doesn't mean that life is good, doesn't mean that you're going to make it, but it gives so many more children a chance to make it. And like I said, this is why you have a civilization, to provide some security, to provide some justice, to provide for the material well-being of most of your citizens, and to give children a chance to thrive. And America is doing that. America is doing that better than we ever knew. We didn't really address it correctly. We never assessed it correctly. And after this study came out, you would think that this would lead other newscasts, but I have not seen any word of this. The New York Times, the most prominent, most important news organization in America, did put it on the front page above the fold. But were you talking about it at the office if you've been forced to come back to work? Which gets me to the depressing part. The depressing part is that all this stuff, which isn't depressing, just doesn't break through, right? Maybe you're saying to yourself, okay, that's all good in the abstract. It's great statistics, but I don't feel it. Doesn't give me a raise, doesn't make healthcare more affordable for me and my family. But think about all the things in the news that maybe depress you, that maybe are off-putting or bummers. Most of them don't really affect you, you know, horrible spate of killings in neighborhoods you probably don't live in. Most of the economic news didn't dock your pay, did it? Made you worried, but it didn't dock your pay. Climate change is real and is a huge issue. When the government passed a bill, which Joe Manchin sought to frame as inflation reduction, but really is the most significant climate change action in years and years and years. I don't know, maybe for one day you said to yourself, it's better it passed than it didn't, but it's not improving your life. And yet every time you read a story about a fire or a flood, that does get you down a little bit. We haven't had any hurricanes this year. Where's the story on lack of hurricanes? I actually read a story on, even with a lack of hurricanes, people are still very nervous in the region that usually experiences hurricanes. So what I'm saying is, good things that are remote almost never bring you a smile. They also almost never flit across your consciousness. It's just not the way our media is organized. It's probably not the way that we as humans orient ourselves in order not to get eaten by lions in the savannah. I get it. But good news abounds. This is an acute example of the good news all happening at once. And all I can do is say, well, good. That's a great thing. Let's acknowledge it. That's it for today's show. Good news! Corey Warr is the assistant producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is the COO of Peachfish Productions, which is really good news. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Peru, G Peru, Do Peru, and thanks for listening.